session number 10764, reel 2.
Mr. Nye, reel 2. Who was in charge of the ship?
Commander Thompson.
What was he like?
I think he was one of the finest captains I ever served with.
What about him?
He was a brilliant tactician in many ways, because when we were on the Russian convoys in particular, you could see this man with his glasses looking up at the sky during the bombing raids. And he literally followed the bombs down on his course after they were released from the aircraft. And he would take very precise avoiding action. Many, many times he saved us. Because as you went over to port or to starboard, harder starboard or harder port, you would see the bomb explode in our wake in the stern. We've had a few near misses, but he was a marvellous man when it came to avoiding it.
Were those the first duties that you took on Martin, the Russian convoys?
No, the very first one was screening the fleet off the Norwegian coast after we'd done our sea trials and joined the 17th Destroyer Flotilla. We were then assigned to cover the fleet on a screen with some tribal destroyers off the coast of Norway. And in this particular screening operation, a disaster happened that lives in my memory today. Was when the KG-5 rammed HMS Punjab, one of the tribal class destroyers. It was a very thick fog, and it was about 4 o'clock in the evening, or just after that, when this accident happened. And we took about, I remember going with leading seaman Whittam was my coxswain, because it was when one says away lifeboats, crew, anybody that's within the vicinity of that boat automatically becomes a member of that crew. So whether you're a cook or a torpedo man or a stoker or whatever you are, if you're near that boat, you jump in and you take part as a crew of that boat. And I remember Lean Seaman Whittam and myself being next to this when we were told, because he was going down to evening quarters, you see. And our captain always believed in it because it was a form of muster. And that way you could always account for the number of men you had aboard your ship or in your part of ship or your mess. So you knew exactly that everybody aboard their ship was there. But unfortunately, I don't think the Punjabi had it. So when she was struck, the stern went down within minutes. And it left the bows afloat, and that's where we saw most of them. But a lot of them were in the water. And I can't remember exactly the number we picked up, but I seem to recall a number of about 43 or 45 people. And out of that, when we got back, these poor devils are covered in oil, because that's one of the things one has to face when a ship gets sunk. They were covered in oil, and a lot of them were slipping through your hands. We were trying to pull them up into the lifeboat, you see. And it was freezing cold. When we got back to the ship and we started taking the survivors off on board, we found two of them that had died in the bottom of the boat through exposure. But that was my first initiation to that part of the world and how cold things can really get.
What time of the year was that?
That was in May. That was in May.
What was the weather like at the time?
Very foggy. Very, very foggy indeed.
And still?
No, it was fairly choppy, actually. And some of the ships were streaming what we call fog buoys. They were like cones, so that you could see keeping distance from line ahead, or a V-shaped formation on the screen. You could pick up this little bow wave of the these little fog cones in the water, so you can keep in line without without it, you'd have to be in constant signal touch with each other, and that was rather dangerous to those days in the war, or radio, because you'd be giving your position away to the enemy.
How did this collision occur, did you know?
Well, I don't know why it occurred, but it was a navigation error on somebody's part, I should say, because the Punjabi was beam on to the KG-5 when she got hit. So if you can imagine a ship going that way and the KG-5 coming along and hitting her amidships and cutting her clean in half, somewhere something was wrong. Because when this, after we'd picked up the survivors and the KG-5 was so badly damaged, we were ordered more or less to take her back to Iceland, I think we took her back to. And then she went down to Liverpool for repairs after that, but she was very badly gashed in the bows. It was just like an alligator's mouth open, to be quite honest. Ghastly sight.
Were the Punjabi survivors saying anything to you about the accident?
Well, there was bad feeling between destroyers, yes. All destroyer, most of the destroyer people were very thick with each other. Whereas the battlers only went out once in a blue moon we were out, morning, noon and night. Anything that was asked of us, we had to go and do. So it was rough, a rough life being on destroyers, yeah.
So the people on destroyers resented the battleship?
I don't say they resent the battleship. They probably resented the crew of the battleships because they used to be swinging around a buoy in Scapa, you know, where we were out all the time. They were there for weeks and then suddenly they decide to go out and do a sweep up the Norwegian coast. I mean, this is an old personal opinion of mine. I don't know what others think, but that's my own personal opinion. There was a certain amount of resentment, yeah, between us and them. And it made it even worse when the Punjabi lost such a lot of people.
What were the next duties of the Martin that you recollect?
The next one was covering force for PQ-15. Yes, covering force for PQ-15. That wasn't really exciting to that extent where we were concerned, because we were with the main fleet escorting, not escorting the convoy, but covering the convoy in case any of the German naval forces came out from the Norwegian fjords to attack the convoy. That was completely uneventful. But then after that, we did one that I was involved with was PQ-16. And that was the foretaste of things that I had to foresee what was to come later on during the next 8 or 10 months up there.
Why? What happened on PQ-16?
Aerial attacks, submarine attacks, but they wasn't so excessive, even though we lost a few ships, they wasn't so excessive as when we took PQ-18 up. I mean, 17 you know about, because it was recognized now as one of the biggest fiascos and disasters of the Russian convoys.
What are your own memories of PQ-17?
Two words, chaotic mess. That's what I think of that lot. A terrific error of judgment must have been made somewhere. But then, looking back in hindsight over that period in time, one would think that the powers to be were right in making the decision they did make about scattering the convoy. Because once you've told a convoy to scatter, there's not much you can do about recovering them.
What did you see of the actual scattering of the convoy people?
Not much, really, because we left. The main destroyer force that was covering it had to leave. And we left and joined up with the fleet, which was battleships, aircraft carriers. I think it was the Duke of York, King George V, Washington, Tuscaloosa, some American cruisers, and there's American destroyers and British destroyers involved in the screen. Because we were, or they were of the opinion, and we were all of the opinion, that the Tirpitz was out, you see, with a couple of their pocket battleships, or if not their pocket battleships, possibly the battle cruisers Nice Now or Scharnhorst, or the Latzug, one of them. We weren't quite sure. We didn't get a lot of information as seamen.
How much did you know of what was going on with PQ-17? Did you know that the convoy had been told to scatter?
Oh, we knew that. Oh, yeah. And this is where, when we knew this, this is when we became very despondent, very depressed, to think that we'd left these poor ships on their own, without any form of defense. And they were literally picked off by U-boats and aircraft willy-nilly. And this is where it hurt, to think that you'd left them. And nothing happened. You know, there was nothing out. There was no battle to take place imminently after scattering. The Tirpitz never did come out. So the Tirpitz won a victory on its own, without even moving out of Alton Field.
You were saying that PQ-18 was much more memorable. Why was
Well,
that?
For me it was, because it... this is where, in our earlier conversation with you, my earlier conversation with you, where I said that when you've been bombed, torpedoed, for 5 days and six nights, and you don't know... You get so disorientated that you don't really know what the time is, whether it's morning, noon, or night. You don't get time to have a meal or a snack of any description. And I was closed up for hours at a time.
This is because of the lack of darkness?
The lack of darkness, yeah. Daylight all the time. And we got it ever since when we left. The convoy used to leave Val Fjord, and the destroyers used to usually go into Seydis Fjord in Iceland and pick up fuel there. And we were spotted, I'm sure, by the Focke-Wulf Condors that were on scouting patrol. But we were picked up there, that they must have known that something was going on. And it was off San Mian Island when we saw this Focke-Wulf Condor circling the convoy. And I remember pretty distinctly, really, when Captain Thompson said to the yeoman the signal, he says, "Flash this bloke," he says, "and ask him to come in a bit closer so he can have a go at him." And he never did. But we fired a few shells just to get a bit of gunnery practice in. Hopelessly out of range, mind you, but it gave them a taste of what was to come. And then within 4 days of leaving Iceland, that's when all hell broke loose. Because the first thing we contended with was with the U-boat attack. And we saw this one on the surface. We first started firing at her. And the shells must have been getting pretty close to her, so she crash-dived. We went over and done a depth charge attack. But one can never classify whether you've literally sunk the thing or not unless you had survivors or means of identification to say that you had sunk something. So you could say it was a no-kill situation. Then shortly after that, the following day, we saw two more on the surface. And... we did the same again with the destroyer Collier Katies was with us at this time, and we both went in to attack her. And a similar sort of thing occurred where we couldn't claim a kill. And then after that, the air raids really came. There was high-level bombing, dive bombing, torpedo attacks by low-flying aircraft, torpedo bombers. And this just continued hour after hour after hour. And where you probably started off being afraid when the actions first started, in particular with some of the younger men that was aboard that ship, they were absolutely terrified. It's come down to me shivering, shaking. And this is where possibly some of us in the, that were active service chaps came into our own to try and comfort and console these characters, you know. And it helped, I'm sure it helped them a great deal, because we'd been through it before. So it wasn't all that bad to these four kids, really. I felt that I doing a decent job regards assisting them, because some of them were really petrified. But then after you've been through it, you know, for the second and third day, one gets used to it, because you're so tired, you don't care anymore as to whether you live or die.
Was the Martin hit on any of these Arctic convoys?
No. Fortunately for us, we never did get hit. Never did. But we got through. We lost about 8 or 10, I think, ships altogether. We got through to Murmansk quite well. But the air raids even persisted inside Kola Inlet. You know, he was still getting bombed in Russian territory, and this is something that one couldn't imagine. I thought, well, yeah, here I am in Russia. There must be airfields around where the Russians can take off and give us a hand, but no way. As I said to you earlier on, all we saw was two little kitty hawks fly over, do a victory roll, and then disappear. And the next minute you were getting a load of bombers coming over from Norway. And this carried on time after time. And this is, we're only 15, 20 miles off the coast.
So did you get any Russian Navy escorts at all?
We used to get two come out a day or so before we got to Kola Inlet. Two destroyers used to come out, but they had no help really. This is where one used to feel a little bit irate or angry maybe, to think that this is what you were doing for them and you were getting no cooperation. I mean, with the material we used to take up there, if I took a previous convoy up, I'd go there on the next convoy, taking stuff up to Murmansk. And literally speaking, we would see the crates of aircraft still there, tanks still there, on the jetty, on the quayside. They just didn't seem to worry about us, whether they moved them or not. I know they were getting bombed pretty heavily. That could have been an excuse for not moving it. But if the equipment was needed all that much, why the hell didn't they get it out of the way? You know, a lot of our own ships just do unloading. Because sometimes the cranes were bombed up and they couldn't use the cranes. So, you know, you began to wonder what the hell it was all about, really. Taking these ships up, they're losing so many lives, going through hell to find that the stuff that you took the week or the month before was still there, not moved.
Did you see much of the Russian dockers?
They were not mixed. When we went into Poliano, there was a club there, they used to call the Red Fleet Club, and when you went in there for a glass of beer or something, mind the beer was lousy anyway, made of onions, I think. And they had no glasses, so you had to drink out of pound jam jars, really. They would not converse with you. Very difficult to get in conversation to find out what they were thinking about the war. Because I think they were afraid possibly because they'd be whipped up by the secret police or something. We tried desperately hard, really, to try and get in conversation with these characters, but no way.
So you never got into conversation with the Russians or made friendships with them?
Not really. Not even when we went into Archangel. Because we had to pick up quite a lot of survivors, American, British, all Allied sailors they were, of merchant ships that had been sunk on previous convoys and were picked up and put ashore there. And I remember being ashore once. This just shows you the Russian mentality. Went to the circus in Archangel. Pardon me. When we came back from the circus, about four of us, they were, went together. He was coming back from the circus, and these, there must have been about 4,000 or 5,000 of them, prisoners of war from Kharkov, German prisoners. And they were marching down the street with Russian guards either side. And I have never seen anything like it, to be quite honest. The brutality. Where these prisoners were being herded through the streets and out the top windows was coming down pots, flower pots, any kind of thing you could think of was coming down on top of these fellows, you see. And if they moved out of the way, they got the back of a butt into their sides or the back of their heads. And if a bloke didn't keep up, he was just pulled out, possibly shot, I wouldn't know. But we didn't stay long, because there was a curfew on us as well.
So the civilians were raining things down on them?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did they seem to hate the Germans then?
Oh, yeah. I think they were, one would use a far sterner word than hate, really. If there was, if that was possible. Because if one visits some of the museums in Leningrad today, or in Murmansk, one can understand the reasons for the hate that there was against the Nazis.
What were these Russian towns like Murmansk and Archangel like in those days?
Very austere. Very austere, very drab. A lot of the pavements, if they were coal pavements, they were wooden planks of wood. And in Archangel in particular. And the sewers or the drains were underneath them. So if you had a loose nail somewhere, like, you know, it was like walking down it on a, watching a Western film that used to walk down and your foot would finish off into a drain below you. But there was a club there in Archangel where we could go to and have a beer or not enjoy the meal, because the meal was, yak meat we used to get and black bread, black rye bread. The soup was made out of potato peelings and cabbage leaves and things like that. Because they were very, very poorly off for food. Even in Archangel, which was quite a way, down the White Sea, away from Murmansk. But Murmansk was devastated, absolutely devastated. The number of raids it had on it, and these buildings being the wood, they all went.
Did the Russians ever try to barter things with you or to get things from you that they liked?
We used to try and work a fiddle. We used to sell, we used to barter it to an extent where we would give them bars. They do sixpenny chocolates we used to have in those days, bars of sixpenny chocolates. And the kids used to give us small bottles of vodka. But one had to be extremely careful. extremely careful, because if you were caught, you were inside.
Caught by the Russians?
Yeah. If you were caught by their police, you were inside.
Did that ever happen?
It happened to one sailor. Yeah.
From your ship?
Yeah, off the Martin. And with a chap called Nigger Rees. He was a Welshman. He was really dark skinned, so we used to nickname him Nigger. And he was caught bartering. We didn't see him again. And because we were only there for about 4 days, I think, in Archangel, but we never saw him again. So whether he was taken into a prison for political prisoners or what, I don't really know. Because we never did find that. Because I never did go back to Archangel again after that.
So it sounds as though you didn't much look forward to going on shore in Russia.
There was nothing to go ashore for, really. Nothing to go ashore for, because you were completely alienated. You was an ally of them, but at the same time you were an enemy.
Did anybody ever show hostility to you?
Well, one had to be very careful when one went ashore, because I say at night time, you had to be back on board pretty quick. And because these chaps were armed, and they wouldn't hesitate to use it, these Russians, they wouldn't hesitate. I think they treated each other with suspicion, really. You know, when you first went up there, I think you heard so much on the radio about our great and gallant allies, the Russians and all the rest of it. And when you got up there, you found a completely different character. He just didn't want to know you. You know, I never found any friendly Russians now.
So you were on PQ 15, 16, 16 17 and 18?
18, yeah.
Those were the four convoys that you did?
Did, on the Martin, yeah.
And 18 was the worst?
18 was, to me, the worst, yeah. Because of the terrific bombings that we got. I mean, there's an incident to do with the a Russian ship, the Bolshevik Star, that was hit, and she was aflame, burning very badly. And once again, I have to mention this chap, Leighton Seaman Whittam. We took a doctor.